This time on your weekly constitutional.
Do we connect or disconnect from the past? And so in some ways, it might be better if we disconnect a little bit from the pride, but we should be connecting more to understanding the consequences. And so a lot of the visitors who are writing, you know, we need to move on, the past is in the past, slavery is over, that kind of disconnecting from the past causes us to not understand each other's pain and to not understand why some things are the way they are now if you just disconnect from the roots of how things happened.
That was Hillary Hicks, a senior researcher at Montpelier. We'll speak with her and Price Thomas, the director of marketing and communications, all about reactions to some of the hard history at Montpelier.
You're listening to your weekly constitutional, hosted by Professor Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at Lincoln Memorial University's Duncan School of Law in Knoxville, Tennessee. YWC is underwritten by the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier.
Hard history is a term you may have heard bandied about. It's one I've been hearing a lot more lately, and it refers, well, as the name suggests, it refers to history that is hard, hard to think about, hard to listen to, hard to read about. In Germany, the Nazi era qualifies as very hard history. In this country, of course, the Civil War, slavery, those are probably the biggest issues in our history that many of us don't really like thinking about. And yet it's important that we do think about them, and that's why I'm so proud of my underwriters at James Madison's Montpelier for bringing the slavery issue front and center. We've talked about that several times on this show. Now we're going to go one step further and talk about the reactions that some visitors to Montpelier have. You see, they've got comment cards at Montpelier, and people do fill them out, and the people at Montpelier read them, and then they talk about them. So I have two guests here with me today. One of them I already know. In fact, I just recently interviewed Price Thomas. Welcome back, Price.
Yeah, thanks for having me again.
Just for the benefit of those who missed your last interview, what is your title here at Montpelier?
I feel like they should be punished for that.
Well, actually, missing it is its own punishment.
That's a good point. I'm the Director of Marketing and Communications here at James Madison's Montpelier.
And we recently had a perfectly fascinating discussion about the great questionnaire that was sent out, the Constitutional Survey. And if people want to listen to that, they can go to our podcast site or simply Google Your Weekly Constitutional. Our podcast site will come up, and Price's interview is either there or will be there very shortly. I think maybe I'm a little bit behind on posting some of our recent episodes, but it will be there very shortly. Fascinating stuff. Price and Francois Baird, who are one of the board members, talked about that survey and its fascinating results. But we are joined today by another person who is making her debut on our radio show. And who are you, if I may ask?
I'm Hillary Hicks, mm-hmm. and I'm the senior research historian here at Montpelier.
Hillary Hicks is such a delightful name.
Why, thank you.
Is that your birth name?
Yes.
Oh, I see. So your parents did that to you on purpose.
They did.
Actually, my last name is Harris, obviously, and my parents considered naming my sister Heather, but they just weren't quite ready to do the alliteration thing. But yours is just lovely. And you are who here at Montpelier?
I'm the senior research historian.
The senior research historian. That sounds like a very important position at a place like Montpelier.
I like to think so. I look up stuff for people who ask me questions.
You look... that's the best job description I've ever heard anyone give on this show. I look up stuff for people who ask me questions.
So that's everyone from general public to research for different projects that are going on in our different departments.
That's cool. So if somebody listening right now simply had a question about James Madison, they could get on the website and figure out where to call you, and then they could say, Hillary, I want to ask you this question.
Yes. And it might be a question I've answered before, and I can answer it really quick, or it might be something that takes a little more looking up.
Well, that is a wonderful service that you provide to the general public. And then you say you also work on ongoing projects.
Yes.
Like what? What are some ongoing projects you have?
Well, a good example would be the Plantation Life Project, which I've been researching various aspects of the running of Montpelier as a plantation. Mm-hmm. And that really got started because of questions that were coming from the archaeology department. So as they were digging in different areas that pertain to the tobacco barn or to agricultural fields, they would be coming up with questions and wanting to know, well, what do we have in the documentary record that helps us understand what we're finding in the ground?
That is so cool. So you're doing real primary sources historian stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And are there lots of records from the plantation era here at Montpelier?
There are lots of records, not always the ones that we wish we had.
Mm-hmm.
So Thomas Jefferson had farm books where he kept particular records related to the running of the plantation. If Madison kept books like that, they didn't survive. So a lot of what I'm doing is gleaning information from letters, and there are a few journals from Madison's father's time period. So it's pulling little pieces of information together and trying to make a bigger picture out of them.
Are you actually still finding new documents? I mean, where do these documents come from? Were they actually stored here at Montpelier, or did you have to go out and find them in archives?
Well, a combination. There's a large cache of James Madison papers at the Library of Congress, and most of them are available online now. And then in the early years of the refurnishing of Montpelier, we started a project putting information into a database. So we had a lot of research associates who were going out to different archives and places where we knew there were Madison records and scanning things. So thanks to the work of those colleagues, I'm able to very quickly pull up a lot of information that is actually in reality scattered in many different archives over the country.
So when the National Trust for Historic Preservation formed the Montpelier Foundation and then started the process of turning this into the place that it is back in the 1980s, one of the first things they did was say to someone like you, in fact, how long have you been here?
I've been here since 2010.
Okay, so to someone like you, not you personally,
not
but one of your predecessors, we need to simply start gathering together Madison papers from wherever they are. Was it sort of a general charge like that? Wherever there's a Madison paper, let's get ourselves a copy of it?
Yes and no. Particularly at that time, we were focused on the refurnishing of Montpelier.
Mm-hmm.
So we were most interested in things that had to do with the Madisons at Montpelier, the Madisons' home life, things that the Madisons were purchasing and receiving as gifts. So we weren't as interested in political information at that point in time. And now our interests have become broader over time.
And specifically now, you're looking at documents that pertain to the actual running of this place as an ongoing plantation enterprise.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a whole area that I've never really thought very much about.
Cows and pigs and sheep and wheat and corn. And
right. And, of course, a nexus with slavery because,
definitely,
of course, the people actually doing the work with the enslaved community.
Exactly.
Which I know has been a big focus, too. Have you been part of that process, putting together the Muir Distinction of Color and the refurbished slave quarters and all of that?
Yeah, I was on the research and writing team for the exhibit.
Mm-hmm. So how long did that take to research all of that?
The whole project, I would say, unfolded over a 2-3 year time period and probably 1 year that was specifically intensively research.
Okay. And so you were still going out and looking in other archives? Or again, where were most of the records regarding the plantation or regarding the enslaved community? Where were they located?
At that point, we pretty much had everything that we needed in the Montpelier Research Database.
You did? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, good. So you are still benefiting from those early efforts.
Definitely.
Okay. So you put together Muir Distinction of Color. You put together the reconstructed slave community, which is, of course, ongoing. And people are starting to come visit. And I think finally we get to the focus of our conversation today. What are the reactions that you are getting to these descriptions of what has been called, what's it called these days, unpleasant history or difficult history,
I
think is the way I've heard it described.
Mm-hmm.
What are the reactions you're getting?
It is all over the spectrum. So we have created...
Price is laughing over there. He's seen these too. Okay.
Uh-huh. We have people who think we made the most wonderful exhibit in the world. We have people who think we made an awful exhibit. We have people who think we didn't go far enough and should have told more stories that were more difficult to listen to. And, you know, it really, every couple weeks I collect these and scan them and circulate them to various people at Montpelier.
Collect these. These are comment cards, right?
Yeah, they're
okay,
comment
we're talking
cards.
About actual physical cards that you leave out. Where are they actually located at Montpelier?
They're in one section of the exhibit, and it's called Leave Your Voice.
Mm-hmm.
And on one side of the cards, we have a quote, one of about 10 different quotes related to race and slavery. So many of them were chosen to be inflammatory because we wanted to get some reaction from people. And so when a visitor writes on the card, sometimes they're responding specifically to that quote. Sometimes they're just giving us a general sense of, I've been through the exhibit and this is what's on my mind now.
Okay, so if I go through Mirror Distinction, which is located in the cellar of the main house.
That's right.
I will come to a point where it says, leave your voice. And I'm going to pick up one of how many different variations on this card are there?
There are about 10 different quotes.
Okay, and I'll find a quote on one side of my card. And I may choose to react to that quote, or I may choose to react generally to the exhibit, or both. Okay, and please. Now that we know what we're talking about, what do you get?
Well, it is all over the map. So it represents a pretty broad spectrum. So we'll have some people who are seeing the exhibit, and it really resonates with them. And they'll tell us they're really happy that we did this exhibit and that we're bringing these stories to light. There's kind of a middle group of people who are talking about, we should all be getting along together, and there should be no race but the human race. We should all be unified.
That's a nice thought.
It's a nice thought. It could mean something positive, that we should all be more caring about each other. It can also mean something negative, that we should just be ignoring and sweeping some things under the rug.
I see your point.
And then on the farther end, we have people who are maybe feeling resentment that somehow they're being blamed for slavery. There are people who are making just very blatantly racist comments. And
Wait a minute.
Yeah.
People are just... like tossing around the N-word and stuff like that?
We had one N-word card,
far. I guess I have great respect for people who visit Montpelier. I mean, I generally think that probably Montpelier and other presidential homes draw sort of a higher class of people. Forgive me, I don't mean to sound arrogant. And if you haven't been to Montpelier, please, I'm not criticizing you. I mean, I hope you come one day. But golly, wow. Some people just show up and they're going to spew Nazi stuff. I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah. And there was a bit of an uptick like last August around the one-year anniversary of the Charlottesville incidents. An uptick?
In racist stuff?
Yeah.
Oh, jeez Louise. Okay. You're not making me happy here.
No.
You're not
making me happy. That's the distressing side of it.
Yeah. Okay. Do we have any sense of who individual commenters are, or is this entirely anonymous?
Sometimes people put a name. Sometimes they just identify themselves. One of my favorite is the woman who signed herself as Old White Lady from Pennsylvania.
Right. Well, okay, that's fine. But we don't ask. We don't say what's your background, your gender, your ethnicity, any of that sort of thing.
And sometimes people reveal that by what they say directly, sometimes indirectly.
Okay. Well, Price, this has been your same impression, right? They're all over the map.
Yeah, I mean, you know, what Hillary said is absolutely true. When you do something like this, you do it with an eye towards not allowing people to be agnostic, right? And so, you know, I mean, this is not it's surprising but not unexpected, if that makes sense, you know. And I think if you live in America today, and especially if you work at a place like this that deals with what we deal with, and you're still surprised by some of the points of view of you know, people who come to your site, you're just not paying attention, you know. And so, you know, for me, I look at these things and I, you know, it's always a little bit jarring to see some of the things that, you know, people still think and are willing to write publicly in 2018. But at the same time, it's not really surprising because, you know, I mean, we know this stuff is going on, you know. And
maybe the best way to describe it is not surprising, but shocking.
A little bit. Yeah,
yeah,
a little bit.
That's what it comes down to. I mean, I can know on one level that this sort of attitude still exists. Okay, I can know that and I'll acknowledge that. And it's maybe even prevalent. And maybe there has been an uptick in recent years. But on the other hand, it's still shocking when I see this sort of stuff, you know, right in front of me. Didn't mean to interrupt you there, Price.
Yeah, no. Well, I mean, I think that's true. And, you know, I think that it's an interesting, you know, demonstrates a little bit of an interesting institutional shift, too, because a lot of, you know, all sites around the country are doing great work and are doing a lot more honest work and a lot more holistic work, right? Mm-hmm. But, you know, a lot of people still expect to come to places like this to get the Screaming Eagles deal, you know. We're sort of red, white, and blue, and God
right.
bless America, right?
Right,
and
right.
The reality of, you know, sort of the American story is that there's a lot of it that's ugly and you know, obviously built on exploitation. And, you know, we didn't get to how we got here, you know, by not stepping on a bunch of toes and knocking a bunch of heads off our own people. So, but a lot of people don't want to hear that part of the story, you know, and that, I mean, we knew that, but again, sort of to your point, when that becomes very apparent in some of the stuff that people are willing to write and even, like, weirdly enough, willing to, you know, sign your name to, it's illuminating, you know, and I don't know how I feel about it one way or the other. I mean, part of me is like, you know, okay, fair enough, you know, and we're doing something right. And the other part of me is just like, you know, come on, man. Like, really?
Come on. It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. And this week it's all about hard history and reactions to it at Montpelier. Stick around. You're listening to Your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week I'm joined by Hillary Hicks and Price Thomas, two people at Montpelier who are telling me about the reactions that they get to the new focus on slavery at Montpelier. Not all of those reactions are very pleasant.
Let's get to some specifics, Hillary. You've got a whole bunch of these comments.
Oh,
you,
yes.
You say you share them, do you? Around Montpelier.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And at some point, we have talked about putting them up on the web in some way on one of our websites, but we haven't quite worked out how we're going to do that yet.
Okay. Well, let's talk about some of them.
Okay. Well, this is just a kind of generally positive one about the exhibit. Someone writes, "This exhibit was hard to hear, see, and feel, but I'm so grateful our family was able to experience such a thoughtful exhibit." So that's somebody who was listening and getting it. And then this one goes back to what I said about those statements in the middle may be positive or may not be. This person writes, "The people writing about not seeing color," so they're responding to things they've already seen, other comments that are up on the board. "The people writing about not seeing color and how race shouldn't matter did not pay attention to this exhibit." "I congratulate all the people who did learn something and challenge them to look forward with an eye for injustice."
Very, very insightful.
Yeah, I really enjoy the cards when people start responding to other people's responses, and sometimes that will happen just on one card.
So if I leave a card, I leave it there, and I leave it on display.
That's right.
So I pin it to a bulletin board, that sort of thing?
Yeah, there's little posts that the cards slide onto.
Oh, I see. So then I put mine up there, and people can see immediately what I've said.
Yeah,
which again makes it shocking that someone would spew a bunch of hatred, and then here I go, hey, everybody look at mine. Okay.
So let me pull one of the back and forth cards here. So this is the first person writing on the card. "The institution of slavery was evil. America abolished it. Be grateful for that and move on. Quit perpetuating hate and entitlement." Now the next person, and you can tell it's different handwriting, it's cursive, and they've got a little arrow pointing up to what was already written. And they say, "You obviously missed the point. Please watch Why Are We Still Talking About Slavery on the TV behind you." So, of course, the first visitor is long gone by the time the second visitor is writing, but they still...
Well, you hope they were, because otherwise you might be having fist fights.
Well, yeah, and that would not be good.
And that has not happened, has it? I mean,
No. Not yet.
not yet.
No physical confrontations to date. But that card brings up an interesting point, because it's sort of... I think people have a much easier time digesting history if it's presented for history's sake, right? Mm-hmm. Here's what happened. Here's what we did. But we're here now, right? You know, I think part of the pain points for a lot of people is that we're saying, look, then connects to now and influences now in some very, you know, very, you know, sort of truthful and upfront ways with regards to how minorities are treated. So it's that gap, I think, that we're often presented with history as history, right? You know, in 1787, this happened and some other things happened and then Obama, we're fine, forget it, let's go. What a lot of people react to is the sort of the notion, you know, our read facts that, you know, history is as an influence on the present. And that's what a lot of these cards or a lot of the, you know, letters that call for my resignation and all this other nonsense, you know, that's what they all sort of reference.
You get letters calling for your resignation?
Oh my God, man. The amount of times that, you know, they've said Kat's been asked to resign and me, and I mean, they've thrown,
because of this
they've thrown the store. Oh, absolutely. And because of the, you know, selling of legacies and all this other nonsense. Yeah, we get, you know, I mean, there was a lot when it opened, and then, you know, we get, you know, one or two a month.
people after you too, Hillary?
Nobody wants to fire the researchers. No, but here's labor in the shadows.
That's the thing. See, and the thing is, and the that's not even a joke. It's the reality is that this place doesn't run without Hillary here, period, mm-hmm. right? I mean, she is the engine for this whole place. But that's the problem is that, right, nobody sees her. So now my next thing is to get her out front and be like, hey, listen.
Right.
She told me all this stuff, right? She's got all the facts.
That should be your standard response. Right. Hillary made me do this.
I just built the website. Hillary told me to do it.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so if anybody listening really wants to write a nasty letter, send it to Hillary Hicks and then you get it. All right. Well, those are the reactions. Well, how does the staff here react to those reactions? How do you, what does that do to the institution here?
Well, I think it opens our eyes because we like to think that we are educating the public, and it helps us to see that there are just some people who are not getting the message that we're putting out there. As Price was saying, it's that connection between past and present and the idea that slavery and racism still has a legacy in America today. That is what we intended to be one of the big takeaways of the exhibit. And so some people are taking that, some people are taking parts of it, some people are not taking it at all.
Hmm. Well, they have been fed a certain storyline, and I don't know if you seen it, and I don't mean to spring this on you. I have not mentioned this to you before, but have either of you seen the recent article in The Atlantic magazine about the continuing funding of the Lost Cause myth throughout many historic sites in the South especially?
Mm-hmm. I don't think I have.
Again, it's not surprising, but it is still somewhat shocking. A really illuminating article that a listener to this radio show, Ben Vernia, one of our stalwart listeners and our posts on our Facebook page frequently, and by the way, if you want to join us on Facebook, please do, Your Weekly Constitutional, or on Twitter. We're at Your Weekly on Twitter. And in either of these places, you can join this conversation. And Ben, who is an attorney in Washington, D.C., shared this article with me recently, and I put it on the Facebook page. And it's all about how not only have traditionally a number of the states of the old Confederacy funded these sites that present this lost cause mythology and this whitewashed version of slavery, but they continue to do so today, and they continue to do so with a significant amount of public funding. Mm-hmm. And the reporters from The Atlantic actually went around to a number of these sites over the course of just the last year or so, and they're still getting this, you know, well, you know, there were some good aspects of slavery, mm-hmm. right? And there was, you know, it wasn't, you know, it was a bad thing, but, you know, there were some good parts of it too, you know, and maybe the slaves were better off here than they would have been if they'd, you know, that sort of
I
stuff.
I think I've read that on the comment
right.
card.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
I mean, the same sort of attitudes are still being perpetuated mm-hmm. today. And so now the picture becomes clearer. If you've grown up within this, which I kind of did, but I'm getting older now. But I mean, even a kid today, or you know, a 20-year-old today who's been brought up on this diet of mythology comes here expecting more of the same, and then all of a sudden is confronted with the ugly reality, then now I start to understand where some of those comments are coming. But I'm going to say mm-hmm. something here that I'm not quite as resigned about it as I might be. Even some of these people who are writing these comments, even some of the nasty comments, you've actually touched a chord with these people.
That's true.
And maybe that's the beginning of the process. Maybe that's the beginning if someone has at least a little bit of an open mind. You've planted a seed to mm-hmm. start mixing my metaphors here. So do you think that's happening?
I think that's certainly possible. And one of the things also that we don't necessarily know when someone writes a Leave Your Voice card, because the exhibit is on two different sides of the cellars, we don't know if someone has been through both sections by the time they get to Leave Your Voice, mm-hmm. or this may be one of the first things they're seeing. These may be the ideas they come in with, and maybe there's some thought process happening later on. Or, you know, I think a lot of times with a museum experience, it's not just what you think about on site. It's the conversation you have in the car on the way home. Mm-hmm. Things may resonate with you later. As you say, some seeds may be planted.
You know, I think that's probably the best part of it. We have a daily version of this show. It's just a 2-minute segment that we run on our home station, WETS, and I think VTF does as well. But it's just basically a 90-second feature that's played during morning or evening drive times, and it's what people in public radio call an earbug. It puts a bug in your ear, and our hope is, and we're always pleased when we hear people do this, is that it prompts conversations in the car. You know, mom is driving to work and is going to drop daughter off at school, and they hear our little daily feature, and then they start talking to each other. And it's really gratifying when I hear from parents saying that, you know, oh, I always talk to my son about this. And then we, you know, we argue about it afterward. And so that's what I think is probably happening here, is that people are getting in their cars after they're leaving. Well, what'd you think of that? I don't know. Well, maybe they made a point. You know, I'd never really thought about it that way. So maybe there are these conversations that are happening afterward.
And it would be interesting if we knew which groups of people came together. Mm-hmm. And that would give you some idea of what the conversation is on the car on the way home. Some of the people who have the stronger opinions that we should just move on and stop talking about these things versus people who are saying that, you know, that there really is a legacy that needs to be explored and understood.
I can see generational conversations going on here. Grandma and granddad bring grandkids here, and granddad has one reaction, but maybe grandson has a different reaction, and then they really get into it in the car. I actually, the very first time I went to Mirror Distinction, I brought my little handheld microphone with me, and I forget which episode it appears in, but it was probably at least a year ago. But I actually went down there and just asked for a few reactions, and I was speaking to one couple who was very positive about it and was going on about it, and we were having a very good conversation. And then this other guy was just sort of waiting, very clearly wanting to be the next in line. So I asked him, and he said, well, you know, that's really not accurate. And he wanted basically to give me the revisionist history about mm-hmm. how slavery was not such a bad thing. And he was very adamant about it. So maybe there's some conversations happening down there. And again, I'm glad there have been no actual altercations. But if they're conversations, if they're civil, then that's a good thing.
Yeah.
Anything else then? Any other comments that you want to share?
Oh, my goodness. Let me see. Well, one of the things also that is interesting is seeing people being willing to call out James Madison on some of the comment cards uh-huh. and thinking about hypocrisy of the founders. Mm-hmm. So here's one. As much as we owe to the legacies of Madison and the founders, their sin of enslaving other people is made far more offensive because they even acknowledge the evil of slavery. If, quote, all that is necessary for the triumph of evil is for good men to do nothing, unquote, then Madison, for all his good, must be seen through that lens. He knew the good he should have done, but was not willing to sacrifice his comfort to do it. So what will we do now?
That is exactly right.
Mm-hmm, sure.
I mean, it is absolutely right. And that's one of the things I'm proudest about Montpelier and about you, Hillary, and you, Price. Nobody shies away from this. Nobody is committing hagiography here. Madison has shown warts and all. And correct me if I'm wrong, Hillary, you're the research historian, but Dolly was, in many respects, even more kind of a willing slave owner.
Yeah, and a willing slave seller.
Right.
I mean, she was in the later 1830s and 1840s, after Madison died, she sold a lot of slaves and was criticized at the time for it. There were people, we never know exactly what it is that Madison told Dolly, but a lot of people in their inner circle felt that it was Madison's intent that Dolly not sell slaves. And so seeing her essentially closing down the plantation, which is what happens over a period of years, selling slaves and finally selling Montpelier, it's not always a pretty picture.
It's not. And we do know that Paul Jennings thought that he was going to be freed upon Madison's death, and not only was he not freed, but Dolly kept him around until basically she was paid off to free him. And I think that came from Daniel Webster, didn't it?
Yeah, eventually she sells him to someone who sells him to Daniel Webster. It seems to have been a planned arrangement.
Right, but she didn't do anything. I mean, she kept him.
And it's interesting, though, that she drew up a couple of different documents that show that she was thinking about what she was going to do, and was she going to free him? Was she going to sell him? So I think there was some thought process there on her part, but certainly she didn't just free him automatically.
Right. I need to correct myself. While you were talking, I double-checked. It was not the Atlantic magazine that had this. It was the Smithsonian magazine.
Okay.
And the title of the article is The Costs of the Confederacy, and I think this was published relatively recently. And it's, again, about this group of researchers that have gone around and talked about how the myth of the lost cause is being perpetuated. But we're not doing that here. We're doing it front and center. And that very insightful comment pointed out something, is that Madison and Jefferson and other founders didn't simply live in an era that we can completely excuse them from any moral sense. You know, it was just accepted then. Nobody even talked about it. No, it was very much talked about it. And indeed, Madison had some pretty extensive discussions with a relative of Dolly's named Edward Coles, didn't she?
Yes.
Or didn't he? Could you tell us a little bit about that story? Because that really tells us how front and center this issue was.
Yeah. Edward Coles was a relation of Dolly's and also served as Madison's secretary for several years while he was in the White House. And Coles was something of a protege of Madison's and very much looked up to Madison. And Coles himself was definitely anti-slavery. And he moved out west, taking his slaves with him, and then emancipated them when he got out to, I believe it was Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
And helped set them up with land and helped them make a transition to freedom. So he didn't just dump them and say, good luck, guys. He tried to do the right thing by them.
Mm-hmm, please.
And so that's kind of Cole's mindset, is he knows it can be done. He did it. And so he apparently had conversations with James Madison late in Madison's life. And Coles believed that Madison agreed with him. And whether Madison agreed at the time and changed his mind later, or whether Madison was just kind of smiling and nodding during the conversation, we don't exactly know. And when Madison's will becomes public record, Coles is just absolutely shocked. And you really get a sense that he feels almost personally betrayed to realize that Madison did not choose to free the enslaved people at Montpelier.
Yep. And they had very explicit conversations about this.
Yes.
The other example, interestingly, and again, please correct me if I'm wrong, is that Dolly had personal experience with what could happen when a slave-owning family freed its slaves, because her father, they were Quakers, freed his slaves, and there followed a period of great economic distress in the Dolly Madison's original family.
That's right. Yeah, her father freed his slaves. This would be in the 1780s, 90s. Don't quote me on the date on that one. So they go to Philadelphia. Her father starts up in the starch-making business, is not successful in that. And so he pretty much dies a broken man a few years later. So that had to have made an impression on Dolly, because she understood how slavery was very much enmeshed in the economy and could be enmeshed in the economy of one family.
Right. So she was born into a slave-owning family. Her father emancipated the slaves. Her family took a terrible economic hit. That had to affect her. Then she married Payne, right? What was his name? Todd. Forgive me.
That's okay.
She had so many different last names. Okay, so then she marries Todd. He's a lawyer in Philadelphia, so it looks like she's going to be essentially a northern wife, non-slave-owning wife, and then, of course, he dies, yellow fever, and then she marries Madison, so she marries back into a slave-owning family.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what my reference was before, is she has seems to take right to it. And maybe it was her example and the example of her family, which was always in the back of Madison's mind, James Madison's mind, whenever he actually considered doing the right thing and emancipating his slaves. He'd seen or he'd heard what happened to Dolly's family when she was a girl. And he feared the same thing for him. Now, I'm not making excuses. I'm simply saying that was
right.
I'm trying to understand his calculus here. But this was very much an issue that was front and center, and people did discuss it. And there was a recognition that slavery was evil. And yet, as this commenter said, he kept his comforts.
Mm-hmm.
And that is quite something to think about.
Almost everybody has some kind of notion of slavery, the system of great oppression, and how they should think about it. So there's a natural hook there. And then we, of course, have some really good histories of slavery and structures to understanding history of slavery. Our job is to translate those interests, those political concerns, those social concerns about oppression and liberation, to give them form so our students can have a way of addressing their concerns.
James Madison, as well as the other founding fathers, would have never been able to write these very important documents without the support of the enslaved community. The enslaved community all over the United States built the United States, and we know that.
So it's important to find a way to address those concerns.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Price Thomas, the Director of Communications and Marketing at Montpelier, and Hillary Hicks, a historical researcher there. And we're talking about hard history, specifically the history of slavery and people's reactions to it. Stick around. And now it's time to finish our discussion with Hillary Hicks, a historian at Montpelier, and Price Thomas, the Director of Communications. We're talking about the reactions, and often the negative reactions, that some visitors to Montpelier have when they're confronted with the very hard history of slavery. All righty. Anything else? Any other good comments there that you want to share?
Oh, let me see. Well, then there's a whole group of, on the racist side of the comments, there's a group of comments where people are just repeating things that have been said as supposed excuses for slavery. So you have Ron, who signed his name on 10/5/18. Ron says, "Slavery has existed worldwide for thousands of years. It is not uniquely American. It is still practiced in some parts of Africa and the Middle East. Americans lose your guilt." And so in reading the comment cards, one of the things that we have talked about is there are certain ideas that I guess we didn't realize people were holding on to so tightly that we wish we had addressed more directly in the exhibit. And two of them, I would say, are this one of the idea that slavery has existed worldwide and how that's actually not a defense of slavery. It might be a fact, but it doesn't excuse anything.
People have been murdering each other for tens of thousands of years. What's the big deal?
There right. you go. I mean, that's basically what they're saying. Mm-hmm. And another one is the idea that slavery was practiced in Africa. So if Africans were enslaved.
Well, Africans, what the heck? They do it to each other. So why don't you know exactly?
So I think if we had realized we were going to see that so many times on the cards, those are ideas that we would have addressed more directly.
Kind of a big banner, two wrongs do not make a right.
There something. You go.
Okay, exactly.
So in future, I think we'll try to find a way to work those topics in.
And inside of all that, though, there's also, you look at some of these people and you're like, you know, okay, fair is fair, but like, what is this place, right? What is the purpose of what we're doing? I'm not educating you on the history of Irish slavery, right? Like, that doesn't pertain to the knowledge base of what the institution is, right? You can find that in other places. Just the same way, you know, I mean, we don't, you know, just talk about things that are irrelevant, you know, insofar as they sort of protect your American exceptionalist view. And so those are the ones that I'm, the ones for me, like those and the sort of people who are like, well, we should all sort of like get along and move on are the ones that are always worry me the most. Mm-hmm. The people who are just like so far gone, I'm like, you know, all right, okay, right? Like, you're not coming back. You know, you've got what you've got, and that's it. The people that are sort of in that middle that seem like they're, you know, conscious enough to understand what's happening and almost, like, willfully, you know, protecting whatever that, you know, kind of, well, I learned in school that, you know, and almost unable to grapple with the reality of the ones that I look at, and I'm like, these are the people who, you know, like, politically, right? You got the polls and the people in the middle, and your job is to what? Try and move the people in the middle. And those are the people that, while I worry about them, I'm like, okay, that might be where the money's made, right? Can you move the people who are, you know, least resistant to some of these ideas into the...
Let me second what you're saying and make a suggestion, because you're right. If you encounter somebody who's just filled with hatred, that person may very well be a lost cause. I mean, you may not ever get them to take off the swastika. I mean, it basically comes down to... but a lot of people who are simply uncomfortable with this want to move on and to something else and want to ignore the problem, and therefore the problem doesn't get addressed. I encounter that attitude fairly frequently in my law classes. Okay, people get very uncomfortable and they accuse me of having an agenda when mm-hmm. I want to speak very openly about, you cannot speak about constitutional history without talking about the greatest crisis in our constitutional history, the Civil War. And yes, it was caused by slavery, by the way. And you'll encounter that sort of resistance, and
that's what I think it is. I think is that there's a perception by some of my students and by some of the wider public that you're trying to guilt these people. That's the word that stuck out in my mind from that last card you read, Hillary, was guilt. You know, yes. Get over your guilt, America. Well, let's just be very clear. There's not one person in this room or listening today who is responsible for slavery. Slavery was abolished, you know, back in 1865. Doesn't exist. Okay, so feeling guilt about something that you didn't do that was done and over with, you know, 100 years before you were born doesn't make any sense. But you've got to acknowledge your own history, and you've got to face up to that history, and you've got to face up to the fact that that history has an impact on today, and that we need to acknowledge it before we can move along, before we can put those issues behind us. And we have to address the continuing legacy of that horrible institution. That's where we're coming from. When the issue over the Confederate flags came up, a few years ago, and still, of course, to this day, and the Confederate monuments, you would get people who would get very, very angry and say, my family didn't own slaves, and, you know, my family proudly displays this flag, and it was about home and hearth for us, and protecting ourselves against aggressive invaders and all the rest of that. Well, okay, that's true. Most people in the Confederate Army did not own slaves. Slave owning was confined more or less to the rich people or the relatively well-off people within white society in the South. But that doesn't change the fact that that was what the war was being fought about. Okay, so even if from the perspective of an individual soldier in Germany in World War II wasn't necessarily a Nazi and wasn't necessarily fighting for that specific cause, but he was on that side. Mm. Okay, we have to acknowledge that that was the case. So an individual Confederate soldier may have never owned slaves and may have had really good attitudes in terms of his attitude toward racial equality, but was still on that side, and we have to recognize that. We have to acknowledge that that happened. And so maybe that's the way to do it, is to acknowledge, you know, very openly in future exhibits, you know, no one is suggesting that anybody here today is responsible for this, but we're responsible for acknowledging it. Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting to me how many times people on the comment cards are saying things where it's expressing resentment, which I perceive as resentment towards the exhibit, that the exhibit is somehow calling them out and making them feel guilty, which I wouldn't say that's exactly the message that we were trying to convey, that you ought to feel guilty, but that's how people are perceiving it. And this is one comment card. Actually, this is a quote on one of the comment cards that draws a lot of discussion. And it's Morgan Freeman in 2005 saying, I don't want a Black History Month. Black history is American history. And you can argue on both sides of that.
Now that's a quote that is in the exhibit.
Right. It's one of the quotes that people can respond to.
Right. So that's up printed on the wall?
Printed on the wall, yeah. Morgan Freeman hasn't been yet to visit us, but we hope he will.
I hope he will. Morgan, you need to come on down. Okay, come on down. We'd love to see you. Just make sure it's on a day when I'm here. Okay, let's go.
So somebody writes on the card, Amen. If we look at it, Americans were ignorant. I apologize, but sometimes I get the feeling white Americans are being held to such contempt.
White Americans are being held in such contempt?
Yeah. So
took an interesting turn about halfway through there, huh?
Yeah. And I guess that's the perception. And I'm sure that wasn't your intention.
No.
So it's a surprise to you that people are reacting that way, that they think you're trying to put shame on current people in the United States who are white.
And my guess is that it's something people have already internalized, is they feel that the culture is telling them they ought to feel guilty, and that they come to the exhibit, and then because we're talking about slavery and race and terrible things, that somehow we are trying to tell those visitors that they should be feeling bad about this. When, you know, it's one thing to feel bad. If we make somebody feel bad in a way that makes them motivated to make change in the world in a positive way, then that's okay. But our purpose is not to get people feeling bad about themselves or...
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, I think that we've really touched upon something here. And if there is a perception among some people that Montpelier or historians generally are talking down to them and telling them that they are bad
and that they should feel ashamed for their history and the history of their ancestors, then they're going to react negatively. So maybe despite the fact that you didn't think you were doing that or telling people that, maybe we all need to be a bit more explicit about that. Maybe that's sort of a disclaimer. Of course, nobody in this room is responsible for slavery, you know, and of course, we're not attacking anybody's family history. It's just that this is what happened, mm-hmm. and we've all got to acknowledge that this happened. I've shared before on this show that it was much to my shock that within the last year or so, I found out that apparently some of my ancestors were slave owners.
No way.
Never had heard that. Not from a particularly wealthy family, but apparently there was at least one branch of the family that had enough money at one time to own a few slaves. And that was quite a shocker. It really was. And I quizzed my mother and I asked her, why the heck haven't you told me this before? Well, it's difficult history. It's not the sort of thing you necessarily publicize, right? But on the other hand, it's not something to be ashamed of because you didn't have anything to do with it. Just as it's not anything to be proud of if your ancestor happens to be George Washington, right? I mean, forgive me for all you George Washington descendants, but you didn't have anything to do with the revolution, okay? That was George. That was, 200 years ago. So maybe that's it. Maybe it's our whole relationship to genealogy and slavery, that we tend to look at our own families especially, and we want to take pride in them. And so the converse is that if they did anything bad, we're going to feel ashamed for it. Maybe we should have a more neutral attitude toward history generally. Even our own family history.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really interesting point. And the dichotomy and reaction from that, right, of, you know, sort of the feeling of pride or call it what you will for something like that, where you came from and what someone who was 400 years older than you in your line did, right, versus the sort of then trying to distance, you know, you can do both, right? You want to be completely attached to, you know, Washington's triumphs and winning a revolution and completely detached from, you know, sort of, I mean, I think we might have a problem. That might be just a problem with introspection, period.
Yeah.
Right? And just like this, what, you know, sort of the, I see from some of these things kind of like, you know, people sort of struggling with their place in an increasingly, like, honestly diverse world, right? And sort of, it them seeming like that, you know, they're, you know, they use the word heritage all the time, you know, or,
yep,
or they're,
that's
or
the word.
Yeah.
That's
yeah,
the word.
You know, or they're, you know, they're sort of simultaneously, you know, being attacked for sins of the father while being like stripped of kind of, you know, a little bit of the power structure that has been, you know, upheld and perpetuated. And so they get caught in this place where it's like, well, it's not my fault that happened, but I still want my cake on the front end, you know? So I find kind of an interesting, a lot of what I read in these things is something that is in no way, shape, or form personal becomes deeply personal to these people.
Yep. And I guess that's really what it comes down to, is that people have a very personal relationship, at least with their own family's history. And it's really wrapped up with their sense of identity. You know, I'm from, you know, the Miller family. I'm from the Smith family. I'm from the whatever family. And we go back so many generations and we did all these great things. And I've seen people do that. Mm-hmm. And you're right. They always want to talk about the good stuff and not about the bad stuff that happened. I've always considered it sort of a good thing that I'm more or less ignorant of my family genealogy because, quite frankly, based upon what I know, I don't necessarily think there were any great accomplishments there. And there might have been some things on the other side. But I've never felt a particular pride nor any particular shame for any of that, because I didn't have anything to do with it. Mostly I wasn't even around for most of that stuff. But I think that that is a phenomenon, a very common trait, and that maybe that's what you historians are trying to overcome. Do you think that's possible, Hillary?
I think that plays a part in it. But then there's also this idea of, do we connect or disconnect from the past? And so in some ways, it might be better if we disconnect a little bit from the pride, but we should be connecting more to understanding the consequences of actions. And so a lot of the visitors who are writing things on the along the lines of, you know, we need to move on, the past is in the past, slavery is over, that kind of disconnecting from the past causes us to not understand each other's pain and to not understand why some things are the way they are now if you just disconnect from the roots of how things happened.
Well, you can put this in personal terms. I mean, think about it. You know, your spouse has some bad experience and wants to talk to you about it, and your reaction is, oh, get over it. It's no big deal. Come on, stop. You know, get back to work.
That's not necessarily very helpful, is it?
Right.
It's, you know, or with anybody you care about, simply telling them, get over it, it's no big deal. Well, that's kind of the equivalent of that comment, isn't it? That's over with. Slavery's done. Forget about it. Stop. Let's talk about something else.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of how it's, you know, sort of enculturated is a little bit along those lines, you know? I mean, I remember learning about things in school. You know, I remember sort of the way it was taught or the way, you know, it's fed to you is sort of that, like, slavery and Reconstruction and Jim Crow are sort of all, like, separate historical eras, right? Mm-hmm. You know, we teach history sort of through the eras. We talk about, you know, prehistory and the Revolution, the Civil War, but these are all disconnected eras, right, and sort of disjointed themes of the American story, you know, that don't have anything to do with one another. It just so happens that they're in chronological order.
Right.
You know?
Right. Then this happened, then this happened, then this happened.
And then, but things get better, and then, you know, we're moving, kind of ticking on through times, and things are improving. And then when,
all by themselves.
All sortly, certainly in a vacuum.
It's not like we have to do anything, because nobody had to do anything in the past. It all just got better.
Yeah, things just improve,
right,
sort of consistently over
because we're Americans.
Because it's progress.
Because it's America.
Exactly,
okay, got it.
Exactly. And, you know, manifest destiny. We'll just go take it if we don't got it. You know, but I think part of it is that when you sort of are confronted with the idea that all these things are in fact connected through and through today, you know, then all of a sudden, and I think, again, part of the sense of identity is I think people sometimes start to look at, you know, they start to have a kind of, like, violently introspective moment where they're like, oh,
like,
am I?
I don't like
this.
Are
you telling me I'm a part of this? You know? And not insofar as, like, you know, hey, you are part of the problem, but insofar as, like, it has been constructed in a way that people benefit from it and some people don't. And here's why.
Right.
You know, and then you see that sort of Pandora's box opens all manner of, the thing I'm most sort of impressed and almost surprised by is the sheer amount. Because when we put this up for, like, remember, for like the first month, nothing happened. Like, nothing. Nobody wrote anything. Nothing happened. So we got all these cards down there. We're like, all right, that was like a cool thing we tried to do. Nothing happened. And then all of a sudden, over the past probably 15 months, it's been explosive. You know, so part of it, to me, it is interesting, is that there's been a real significant uptick in the feedback, you know, high, low, and otherwise. Just the sheer breadth of it has increased, I mean, a thousandfold.
Very interesting. Well, Hillary, you and your research historian compatriots are clearly stirring up the pot.
But we're in the shadows, so you can't find us.
You can't find it. You're stirring it up from back there, and then people like Price have to deal with it. Well, thank you for stirring up the pot, and thank both of you for coming in and speaking with us today about it.
You bet.
My pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
And that's our show. Thanks so much to our guests, Hillary Hicks and Price Thomas of Montpelier, who've told us all about the difficulties of exploring the hard history of slavery there and people's reactions to it. If you're interested in these topics, go ahead and go to our podcast site. Simply Google Your Weekly Constitutional. One of the first sites you come up with will be our podcast site, or maybe you want to access it via iTunes or Spotify. And then with the search engine, you can find all sorts of episodes on slavery, on Montpelier, on this early period in our history, the Confederacy, all sorts of hard history. We don't shy away from it. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by Hannibal's Elephants. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment, not all of which is pretty.